It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up in Wisconsin, 17-year-old criminal offenders are charged as adults. Governor Tony Evers has proposed changing that. We'll hear about the experiences of juvenile offenders and learn how trauma-informed care could become a part of criminal justice. First, it's the week in Washington with a look at top stories in national politics. The big story today, the House of Representatives gave President Biden's nearly $2 trillion COVID relief measure final approval today without any Republican support. Biden could sign it into law as early as Friday. A few other stories we'll check out. Several Republican senators have announced they won't be running for re-election. How does that impact the 50-50 partisan split in that chamber? And a significant voting rights bill faces a lot of Republican opposition in the Senate. Could that force a reckoning over the filibuster? You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does it feel to see this COVID relief effort coming to the finish line? Do you support it, oppose it, a little of both, depending on which part you look at? Tell us what you like and don't like. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa Mascaro is chief congressional correspondent for the Associated Press. Lisa, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I want to give a listen to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi talking at a press conference about the passage of the bill.
My praise right now goes to the President of the United States, Joe Biden. This is the Biden American Rescue Plan. It will be followed by the American Recovery Plan. And it's about just that, saving lives and livelihoods and giving people hope for the future.
We've been following this bill for quite a while. You have too, I know. Can you talk about the final push to get this passed, first in the Senate and then now in a revised version in the House?
Yeah, absolutely. It has been a long haul. Of course, President Biden's, you know, just top domestic priority here, getting this big rescue plan through Congress. And boy, it really is, you know, it's coming here on the 50th day of the president's being in office, so he's sort of halfway to that 100-day sort of milestone that we always measure. And for Democrats, you know, this is a pretty big win. It's also a definitely partisan win. You know, there were zero Republican votes for this plan in either the House or the Senate. And that's going to be some, you know, some really telling politics that we're going to be watching now for the weeks and months ahead. As you said, it's been a long time coming. So they worked, you know, gosh, round the clock last week in the Senate. They made some changes to make sure they could get it through the Senate with that very, you know, narrow. Democrats had zero votes to spare. So they had to have all 50 of their Democrats on board in the face of this Republican opposition. And then They did make some changes, not a lot, but enough that were substantial. It went back to the House. House finished it, passed it again just now this afternoon. And Speaker Pelosi and Leader Schumer had a press conference, you know, on the steps of the Capitol announcing it. You know, this is a big, big package, and there's a lot of stuff in there for a lot of people. And Republicans are really counting on, you know, being able to sort of sell this as, you know, too much, right? $2 trillion, big, bloated, things that have, you know, nothing to do with COVID. That's how they plan to argue this. But, you know, it's going to be interesting to see if that really sticks, because there's a lot of stuff in here for, like I said, a lot of people. You know, there's these direct payments to Americans. There's a big boost in the child tax credit that people can start receiving as sort of a monthly stipend for their to help them, you know, through this period. Of course, there's, you know, money for vaccines and vaccine distribution and reopening schools. It's polling very well right now. So I know the Associated Press had some polling about, you know, the president's handling of the pandemic was very high. So we'll see if that sticks and if this very partisan vote ends up, you know, being a benefit to Democrats, or will it be a problem for them, you know, down the road?
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jacob is with us in Toma. Jacob, hi.
Yeah, how's it going, Betty?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jacob?
Yeah, I watching the news about this darn COVID bill, and, you know, I'm hearing they're they're talking about spending $2-3 gazillion on this thing, and not a darn person can tell me what is in there that's going to stop the darn COVID.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Right. And the main part of this is COVID-related economic recovery, right? Lisa, you mentioned the direct payments plus support for small businesses and big businesses like airlines and some others. Jacob's wondering, I think, about what is in there related to COVID. You mentioned some of the money going to vaccine. Are there other things directly related to the public health side of things as opposed to the economic recovery side of things?
Yeah, no, you're right. And that is a big criticism of the bill. But, you know, there is the money for vaccine distribution. There's money for testing and contact tracing. And, you know, I think the public health officials have been saying, you know, you have to get people tested. You have to, you know, make sure they're able to sequester, you know, and get the treatment that they need so that they aren't spreading it. And so, you know, there is the money to do that kind of testing and then to get everyone, you know, who wants a vaccine vaccinated, right, to try to get as many people as possible vaccinated. And I think the public health folks will tell you, you know, this is a novel coronavirus, right? It's a new virus. They're learning about it every day. We have these new strains. There might be, you know, a need for booster shots after you get the initial vaccine later. You know, this will be something that is around, it appears, for some time. And what, you know, Americans will need to do is figure out how we're going to, you know, incorporate the treatment and the prevention in our healthcare routine. So, you know, people get a flu shot every year, right? Maybe we're going to have to get COVID shots every year. You know, these are things I think we're all learning as we go here. And the bill does have funding in for that. Of course, for continued research and all of that into these treatments and vaccinations. And, you know, and I don't think this is the end of the line on that either. I think, you know, there will be the annual big appropriation bills coming from Congress where they drill down, you know, in the different departments. Okay, does, you know, NIH need more money, the National Institutes of Health, or, you know, Health and Human Services, you know, getting money out. And I will also just back up and say there is a lot of money going to the states and cities, you know, that have the public health departments that are on the sort of front lines in, you know, in distributing a lot of this and getting a lot of the health care out to people. So there is a lot of money going to that as well.
Thanks for the call, Jacob, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the Associated Press, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Now, Lisa, as hard as it was to do this legislation, this was kind of the easy one in some ways because Democrats could use the reconciliation process. They don't need 60-plus votes to get it to a vote in the Senate for something like this. You can only use that for certain kinds of legislation. You can only use it a couple times a year. So any other big agenda items, right, are going to be a taller order as long as the filibuster is still there. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I will just add on to that list that you said. I think there was also just a momentum, right? Democrats, you know they're sort of on borrowed time. They have, you know, the White House, the House, and, of course, this evenly split Senate, you know. The House is also very narrow, you know, just a 10-seat margin over there. So they knew they had to sort of, if they wanted to accomplish something early, they all had to hang together to get this done. And they did, you know, and so that will be part of their challenge moving ahead. But like you said, they can only use this, this 51-vote threshold, you know, maybe one more time this year. And, you know, there is a lot of talk about using that for the next big package, which will be President Biden's campaign issue of the Build Back Better. So this would be a big infrastructure package that would have, you know, roads, bridges, broadband, you know, some green energy kinds of things in it, lots of different things that might go on that package, perhaps additional COVID-related as well. But that's, you know, weeks, if not months away still. That's another big package. We probably won't hear start really seeing the contours of that for several months now. So in between, then to your point, right, what do you do? There are all these bills coming over from the House. There's a lot of talk in the Senate about trying to get rid of the filibuster, which is, you know, this old sort of historic tool that's been around for almost 100 years where they are able to have the voting threshold at 60 votes. It's sort of a supermajority instead of 50. And there's a lot of talk about changing that. It doesn't seem that Democrats have enough support right now to fully change that. But, you know, we might see some things around the edges. So I think, you know, this spring there's going to be a lot of bills coming over from the House that the Senate's going to have to take up and see what happens. So these are bills on voting rights, for example, on perhaps, you know, equity in the gay rights space, in gun legislation, in legislation following the killing of George Floyd, in the police reform space. So a number of bills that, you know, could potentially be popular with Americans. And the Senate's going to start processing those, it seems, and sort of see what happens. You know, can they get any of this stuff over the finish line? Will Republicans block it? And if Republicans do just sort of block everything in this very partisan way, do Democrats then sort of, you know, hunker down and talk about really changing some of these rules to make it easier, you know, to lower that voting threshold to 50 so that they can get some of this stuff out, you know, and over the finish line.
We're talking to Lisa Mascaro from AP about several top stories in national politics, including the latest in Congress with a major voting rights bill she mentioned. We'll get to that. And the election landscape for 2022 and the U.S. Senate. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with more of your thoughts on the latest relief legislation. Do you think the filibuster should go away? Why or why not? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for AP, looking at the top stories in national politics. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Junction City. Dave, hello.
Hello. Yeah, my question would be is, I think you need to address why the Republicans were probably voted against this. I'm sure they're not against the COVID relief package part of it, but there's at least 20% pork in this bill when you have $86 billion to go fund bailout for pensions, for another $40 billion for mass transit. There is quite a few, if you dig deep, of what could be spent better elsewhere at this time.
Dave, thanks a lot for that call. And Lisa, Dave, highlighting some Republican objections there, saying, you know, we could do this for less, and pointing out things that are not directly related either to COVID public health or to directly to COVID relief. What kind of things are we hearing?
Well, that's true that there are Republican objections, and they offered a number of amendments in the Senate trying to get rid of some of that money. But, you know, those amendments failed, and this is where we're at with this package. I mean, I think that is definitely sort of the argument that Republicans will make, you know, as we said at the outset, that it's just too big and they could have done a more tailored package. You know, I think you heard Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats today sort of explaining it. I mean, Pelosi said, look, you know, we backed up pensions because we want grandparents to be able to be stable so that families are stable, you know, through this pandemic. So, you know, both sides are going to have to really test their arguments out before voters and see where it falls. You know, I think Democrats are banking on this being, you know, they're sort of not shying away from this. They're saying this is, you know, one of the biggest bills that they've passed in decades. You know, some are comparing it to the, you know, LBJ's Great Society, or, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, you know, FDR's New Deal. You know, they're sort of hearkening back to these big government projects. And one of my colleagues and I wrote a story the other day about they're sort of not afraid of portraying themselves now as, like, you know,
we're the government, we're here to help you. You know, to sort of borrow the, you know, the old Reagan line. And, you know, Republicans are going to throw that right back at them and say, hey, this is too big. So, you know, I think voters are just going to have to sort of assess it, see what they think. Is this, you know, project helping them or not? And, you know, we'll have an election here, a midterm election in November 2022, and we'll see where the chips land on all of that.
Dave, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Well, speaking of that election, we know at least five names that won't be on ballots, five names of currently serving Republican senators, with Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri being the latest to say he's not going to seek re-election. Can you talk about what that means for the 2022 race? Obviously, with a 50-50 tie in the Senate, the Senate race is a big deal.
Yeah, it certainly is. And, you know, the Republicans, you know, today's the day where both caucuses in the Senate have their sort of private lunches to assess how things are going. And the Republicans had theirs off campus at their campaign headquarters to talk about exactly that, 2022. And, you know, with these seats up, it's really a test for the Republican Party moving forward. You know, this is a party that's really in this growing pains moment of whether it's going to continue to sort of align with the kind of party that former President Trump built, you know, sort of leans more populist, maybe doesn't adhere to some of these traditional kind of Republican ideas of, you know, no deficits or some of the spending issues. And that also is really animated by, you know, some of the big social issues, some of the big culture war issues that former President Trump, you know, spoke about, you know, quite a bit, you know, immigration, the different issues out there in the culture space. You know, or are they going to sort of cue back to some of their earlier positions? And these senators who are retiring are among some of the more centrist senators in the Senate. You mentioned Blunt. Of course, there's Rob Portman in Ohio, Pat Toomey, you know, who is a conservative senator in many ways, but also, you know, very, very willing to sort of engage in a productive way out of Pennsylvania. And who the party nominates to run in those states will really set the pace here, you know, really decide which way the Republican Senate will go. And you've seen a lot of warnings from the Republican campaign side. They've been here before. You know, folks might remember the rise of the Tea Party in 2010, when a number of Republican candidates got nominated for a Senate that then could not win statewide elections. You know, there was, gosh, Christine O'Donnell in the state of Delaware, and there was in Indiana, Richard Murdoch. You know, there were a number of these candidates that were just too far to the right for voters that, you know, statewide, you elect your Senate from, you know, from the state. And so some of the campaign strategists from the Republican Senate side have been sort of warning, you know, and just encouraging everyone to sort of, you know, let's be sure to elect candidates that can win. But, you know, former President Trump is still a big player out there. He likes these candidates who align with him. A number of candidates are expected to align with him. And so, you know, those candidates could certainly benefit from the president's, you know, stamp of approval. So, that will be the thing to watch on the Republican side, you know, in the weeks ahead.
And I wanted to ask you, Lisa, how closely you at reporting in Washington are watching Wisconsin to see if there's a sixth Republican senator on that list of people not running for reelection. Senator Ron Johnson had said he wouldn't run for a third term some years back. Now he says maybe yes, maybe no. Are people really watching that decision closely from the Capitol?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, a lot of folks thought he would go ahead and retire, but he seems to be keeping that door open. And of course, you know, Senator Johnson has really made a name for himself, you know, running when the Republicans were in the majority, running the Homeland Security Committee. and going after some of the investigations. And it is interesting to sort of see him maybe think about sticking around and what kind of place he would have, you know, in Wisconsin politics and in staying in the Senate. So we'll be watching for that decision too. What do you think? Will he stay?
I would quickly go broke gambling on what politicians are going to decide to do. I will not weigh in on what I think will happen because I don't know. Big agenda items. We mentioned that the voting changes. We're going to talk about that tomorrow on Central Time. What other pieces of legislation are you watching for next in Congress in just our last minute or so?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the big things is the return to the minimum wage issue. You know, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour had been in the rescue plan. It got knocked out because of Senate rules, as you mentioned earlier, very strict rules on what can be sort of allowed in these reconciliation packages. The House is expected to vote again next week on sort of a standalone bill that will increase the minimum wage over a number of years, I believe it's 5 years, to $15 an hour. Currently, the federal minimum is set at $7.25 nationwide. So it would be an enormous, and that will be another big test for the Senate. This, too, is a very popular item. Republicans oppose it. Democrats believe the American people are on their side, and so we're going to have a big test of that once it gets through the House and lands over here in the Senate.
Lisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, Rob, thanks so much for having me.
That's Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the Associated Press, joining us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to two activists who were formerly incarcerated as juveniles and hear what changes they think Wisconsin's criminal justice system needs to make. We'll also hear from a Wisconsin pediatrician who talks about trauma-informed care as an important part of the process. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, schools around the state are figuring out how to help some kids catch up after a year of at-home learning, including a possible new look for summer school. Find out more tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, according to the Wisconsin Alliance for Youth Justice, there are 410 incarcerated people serving 20 years or more in Wisconsin who committed crimes as minors and were charged as adults. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that life without parole sentences for juveniles are unconstitutional. The rulings are based on research showing that juveniles don't have the same brain development and decision-making abilities as adults. Wisconsin is one of 26 states that has yet to update its laws on juvenile justice since that ruling. 17-year-olds are automatically tried as adults, something Governor Tony Evers has proposed changing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience in the juvenile justice system? What, if anything, should Wisconsin change about how they approach minors who have committed crimes? Call 800-642-1234. Garland Hampton is a juvenile justice activist. He founded the organization STAND, Standing Tough Against Negative Decisions. Garland was tried for a crime as an adult at age 15 and spent over a decade in prison. Garland, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us now, Domine Meek is Milwaukee team leader for the Wisconsin Alliance for Youth Justice. At 15, Domine was tried as an adult and spent nearly 28 years incarcerated. Domine, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, Domine, you've spoken about a trauma you experienced as a kid. How did those experiences affect the way you thought and made decisions as a teen?
Well, the traumas I experienced as a child, a lot of physical, mental, emotional abuse, and at one point sexual abuse, it caused me, I mean, this well documented how it affects juveniles, but it caused me to isolate myself. It caused me not to trust adults. It caused me not to want to speak to adults or be around adults. And even my peers, I couldn't trust them because I didn't know if they were going through the same things that I had experienced. And so who do you trust? You know, so I pulled back from everybody. I was very angry. I had very low self-esteem. And when it came, it made me very susceptible to the lure of joining gangs, you know, to be like one who I idolized, a family member who I idolized at the time, and become, in my eyes, tough like he was. And, you know, so, yes.
And Garland, same question. How did your negative experiences as a kid shape you as a teen and your decision, you ending up in a gang?
Well, it made me feel hopeless and helpless. I was vulnerable. And from that experience of feeling vulnerable, it seemed like it made me susceptible to all forms of abuse. So being that I was raised and grew up in an environment full of violence, I turned around and resorted to what I was used to seeing as a way of defending and warding that off. So I became to be very destructive myself. Fighting, joining gangs, carrying guns, and it didn't end there until it landed me in prison. Once I was in prison, I began to fight. But all of this was a cry for help, for someone to sit me down, give me the help that I need, and address my issues that I was dealing with, all of the physical abuse, the mental abuse, the sexual abuse, and the verbal abuse. And this was happening to me by my own family members, my own loved ones, the people who I thought would protect me. And I said, if they are my biological family and they are the ones that's causing this harm to me, then who wouldn't cause harm to me? So that caused me not to trust no one. And while I was in prison, after, you know, going through all of this pain and began to become my own victimizer, I just got tired of living in pain. And I said, hey, look, either you can tell someone to get help or you can continue to go through this. And one day I walked into my social worker's office at the prison I was in, which is New Lisbon Correctional Institution. And I told my social worker, I said, hey, look, I need to talk to you. I got something that's been bothering me for years. And when I told her that, you know, I was sexually abused as a kid, you know, and all the trauma and abuse that I've been going through, she referred me to see one of the psychologists, and from there, the help and treatment that, you know, I was seeking for so many years, I was beginning to receive it. But, however, it became still where I didn't trust the system because the system left me as a kid in the adult prison system to seek it upon myself to get the help for myself that I needed. So I asked the question, what kid is going to be in his own best interest in getting help for him or herself when they have been raped, abused on all levels, and have no one to defend for them?
And Domine, so, I want to bring Domine back into this. For that 15-year-old today, maybe in that same situation that Garland and you were in, what would work? What do you think that they would need to help them as opposed to just going right into adult prison?
So one of the first things they definitely need is the professional counseling, mental, emotional treatment to deal with the issues. But more than that, people say, what can they do? I always tell people, you know, do what you would do for your loved one. You know, if you got a son or a daughter that's being abused or that's facing going through the adult system who suffer trauma, what would you want for them? Do that. You know, that's what that child needs. They need the help. They need someone that's going to love them and care for them and be there for them. And they go say that because they were spurned one time when they reached out, that child don't want no help, that child can't be helped. No, they need somebody that's going to come back again and again and again and say, I love you enough that I will keep on coming back until you end up in a place, hopefully not prison, but, you know, it could be where I can't get to you no more. But until then, I'm going to keep on coming back and helping you, offering you this help, showing you that I love you. Because so many people have given up on us after trying one or two times, maybe three times. They're like, oh, we're irredeemable. We're super predators, as they used to call it, whatever, you know what I'm saying? We can't be saved. So, yeah, lock us up. That's what they say, you know what I'm saying? So somebody that's going to come back time and time again until they get through to us. That's what's needed.
And, Garland, you have this organization, Standing Tough Against Negative Decisions. What are you doing through that organization for this next generation?
Well, that organization, it helps. It gives kids a safe place to open up about these kind of abuses that they are going through, because most kids, when going through something like this, they scared to come to their parents, or some of them can't go to their parents and talk to them about it because there's this fear of, will my mom believe me? Will my dad believe me? Or will my mom believe me when I tell her that it's my father, it's my brother, it's my uncle, it's my cousin, the one that's raping me and abusing me? And so kids become silent. And what I did was I opened up and shared my story, you know, trying to make it safe for them to open up and share their story, because we can't help them if we don't know what the problem is. But however, we know that there is a problem with them because they have a disturbing behavior. And I learned that from my own experience, when you have a kid that have a disturbing behavior where they're acting out, whether it be violent, fighting, or being destructive, that's a cry for help. There's something wrong. So these are the telltale signs that there is something wrong. And the STAND program gives them an opportunity and chance to come to someone who they can feel safe and comfortable with and share their issues, their problems that they're having. And then we turn around, and if we can't give them ourselves the proper counseling and help that they need, then we are resourceful to reach out to those who we know can help them and give them the proper treatment that they need for their problem.
And Dominic, as we wrap up, something that sticks to my mind hearing you and Garland's story, I think a lot of people look at it from the outside to say, why would a kid join a gang, expose themselves to danger? But it sounds like, compared to the abuse you both suffered, a gang felt like in some ways a safer, stable environment with people you felt like you could count on. Do I have that right?
For me, I would say yes. I can't speak. I'm probably for Mr. Garland as well. But, yeah, so I knew what to expect in the streets. You know what I'm saying? I knew that the people who were who I consider to be my opposition, that they wanted to beat me up and wanted to hurt me. I prepared for that. You know, but the abuse I suffered from loved ones and things like that, that I wasn't prepared for. I wasn't ready for that. So I ran to the streets where I could be safe, protected by those who love me and who I felt that if somebody tried to hurt me, they got my back. Because in the house, it was just me. But in the streets, with my brothers in the gang, it's 10, 20, 30, 40 of us, or more of us if we need it. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, it provided a sense of safety for me anyway. And that's, you know, yeah, it was safer for me. I felt both emotionally, mentally, and definitely sexually. They had to suffer the sexual abuse in the streets that I received at some point or another in the house, in the homes I lived in. So, yes.
We'll leave it there. I want to thank you both. Dominic, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me again.
And Garland, thanks for sharing your story with us.
No problem. Anytime. And I thank you all for having me.
Garland Hampton is a juvenile justice activist. He founded the organization STAND, Standing Tough Against Negative Decisions. And Dominic Meek is the Milwaukee team leader for Wisconsin Alliance for Youth Justice. They were both at age 15 charged as adults and spent years in the adult correctional system. Coming up, we'll talk with a Wisconsin pediatrician about these issues and trauma-informed care. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your own story on either side of the juvenile justice system as a youth yourself or somebody who worked in that system. 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about trauma and how it affects juveniles in the criminal justice system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for our next guest, a Wisconsin pediatrician, or an experience to share yourself, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Dipesh Nafzaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Nafzaria, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here again.
Well, I've seen you, Dr. Nafzaria, talk about trauma-informed care, the impact of trauma on our brains, on our decision-making, and we just heard incredible illustrations of how that can work from our last two guests. Can you talk about what you heard in their stories?
Yeah, and first of all, I just want to say that for Dominic and Garland to come on and share their story publicly, and I suspect that they've done this in so many other venues as well, is brave and I think a service to us all to recognize kind of their experiences and also to highlight for us how much perspective they've gained. What you heard were mature adult brains reflecting on their lives, on their childhood, on what they did as adolescents, and of what the results were. This was the perspective of mature adults, which is not necessarily the perspective that teenagers or adolescents can always have, particularly when they're coming out of trauma situations like that.
Can you talk about the impact that psychological trauma from things like abuse that they talked about can actually impact the physical development of our brains?
Yeah, so the number one driver of child development is strong, supportive, nurturing relationships. We have tons of science backing this up, and we know that the single most important thing is a caring, loving adult, at least one, hopefully more, but at least one who's absolutely nuts about that kid and is there for them, is in their corner and backs them up. When children don't have that because of the environments that they're raised in, and that's often, of course, a perpetuating thing because it's often that the parents aren't getting support, they're not, you know, safe, they don't have jobs, they don't have, you know, they may suffer from substance use disorders and so on, right? That child is not getting that reciprocal feedback, right? Even it starts as simple as, I smile at my parent, does my parent smile back at me, you know? I'm hungry, I'm tired, I'm hurt. Does my parent tend to me? Do they feed me? Do they comfort me? All those things. And what happens is at a very young age, you start to view the world as threats. You start to view the world as not fulfilling your needs. And you tune your brain, the neurons wire, looking for danger, looking for harm, looking for what you need, right? Food and things like that. And you don't live in a world where you're expecting support, where you're expecting love, where you're expecting to be nurtured. And then that feeds forward into these environments that you heard about. And I think it's also key to recognize, we often talk about this as a series of deficits, right? What aren't kids receiving? It's often termed adverse childhood experiences. Well, we also need to be talking about, okay, but what are the positive childhood experiences? Even in situations where children may or may not be, and families may not be doing so well, are there things we can do that make sure that they are supported and help decrease the impact of this starting at the early years, not waiting till years later?
I want to ask you about those early years, but first I want to talk about that kid in the situation that Garland and Domine were in as they entered their teen years, as they entered gangs, ultimately convicted of violent crimes. For that kid who's spent 12, 13 years not having that situation, having those adverse experiences, what kind of interventions can we do that are going to help them at that stage avoid going where Garland and Domine did?
And I'll just highlight this by saying part of my clinical work is providing services at the Juvenile Detention Center in Dane County. So besides the work I do on early brains and early sure. prevention, I also see what happens at the far end when things don't go so well. I would argue it's a number of things. Something that came out in their story is about trust, right? You got to have a consistent person who's there in their corner and doesn't keep kind of rotating through. How many social workers do you think that, you know, they or anyone else in their situation may see? How many therapists, how many people that are there to help them, right? Our systems are so fragmented, this high turnover and burnout rates, it makes it hard for them to develop that trusting relationship that, hey, this person's here for me and they're not just going to leave in the next 2 days. So I think it's that. And then it's also making sure that when we do give them opportunities for rehabilitation, for trying again, that it's real opportunities. We're often sending youth back into neighborhoods where the economic opportunities, the educational opportunities, the opportunities to be safe are really awful. Is it any wonder that they often reoffend and get into trouble yet again? We think about a prevention and rehabilitation mindset, but we don't think about it globally in terms of our society.
We're talking to Dr. Dipesh Navsaria about trauma-informed care, alternatives to prison for younger offenders. And Dr. Navsaria, you mentioned ways to support parents or other caregivers for kids at that early age to avoid some of the traumas our earlier guests experienced. What kind of things do we need?
Yes, and I do want to highlight, by the way, that it is always possible to do rehabilitation and remediation, right? Like even in adults. So it's not that if you don't do it early that, you know, we give up. But it's a lot easier to prevent this earlier on. And I'm fond of saying that, you know, we talk about trauma-informed care, right? An approach that thinks about trauma, takes it into account, and, you know, uses that approach. I also point out, however, that if the trauma doesn't happen in the first place, then we decrease the need for those approaches as well. So what can we ask, have people do? Well, one, we can do things like strong primary care networks that are asking about social needs around housing security, food, safety, and so on. We can make sure people are provided a living wage and that there's actual jobs for them so that there's economic stability. We can offer things like evidence-based home visiting programs, of which there's many that are out there, but they're not easily scaled because of funding. All of these supports that come in before the problems start are much more effective and a lot cheaper than trying to go and fix things later on, or frankly, sink money into corrections where it's far less effective in terms of a per dollar basis.
I hear sometimes about generational cycles of abuse. Someone who's brought up abused as a child, likely if they don't find another path to maybe recreate that situation. Do you see enough being done to interrupt that cycle?
You know, I'll start by saying that I don't think that's necessarily a given. I think there's also people who go the absolute opposite direction of their own experiences. But again, we need to think what's the environments that we're setting up, right? The levers that we can pull as adults, right? What's the advice we give? What are the programs we offer? What's the policies that we enact? Does it actually do we make it easy for people to succeed? And I'm also going to add that the one thing we haven't mentioned yet is that there's a huge, huge element here that is the structural racism and discrimination that we are talking much more about in the last year. And that is an enormous part of this at all levels, coming from prenatal care all the way up through what we're talking about in terms of the justice system.
I also wanted to ask you about, you mentioned the courage of our previous two guests, Domine and Garland, in being willing to come out and talk about their experiences with abuse. Do you think that people still feel a stigma, even though they're the victims of these things, a stigma if they come out and talk about these things publicly?
I think there's a stigma, and I think, frankly, honestly, it can be even more acute for men sometimes who are supposed to be tough and not be victims. But that's not to say that it's not easy, that it's easier for women or anything. By no means am I implying that. But I think that makes it harder. But the other thing is, think about a young child, right? Young children, sometimes they start thinking, well, I must deserve this, right? I must have done something. And that's what they hear, right? Well, if you picked up your stuff, I wouldn't have to beat you, you know, or whatever the case may be. And the time they spend blaming themselves and believing that they really deserved it, is that reverberates sometimes for decades upon decades, and it may not come out for ever, really.
In our last few moments, Dr. Nafzaria, are you hopeful that there's enough attention to these issues now that we're going to see serious change in the years to come?
Well, I'm hopeful that we know what to do. We have the science behind it. We have interventions that show that they can work. We have all those things. It's not that we're just unclear on what needs to happen. The thing where I need more hope in is that we're actually going to meaningfully put resources around this in terms of decreasing poverty, decreasing racism and discrimination, and really believing that we're all better off when we make sure everyone's properly cared for.
Dr. Nafzaria, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you.
Dr. Dipesh Nafzaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He provides clinical services at the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center and talked to us today about childhood trauma and how it relates to juvenile offenders in the criminal justice system. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a bill in Congress would create big changes in American elections and limit the power of states to limit voting access. We'll get the details about the proposed changes and what they would mean for the way we vote. And the pandemic has shaken up the daily meal schedule for a lot of people, and that may not be a bad thing. Our guest tells us there's nothing magical about three meals a day. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Today it's online playlists. but not long ago it was mixtapes on audio cassettes. And we say farewell now to the inventor who made them possible. Lou Ottens came up with the idea of the cassette tape and helped invent CDs, too, later in his career. Now, recordable cassettes were a big part of my childhood, and it's kind of a generational marker, you know, if you remember using the pencil to twist those loose tapes back in. Big part of my childhood, but not part of producer J. Carlisle Larson's. Hey, JC.
Hello.
So you said earlier you had exactly, precisely one music cassette. What was it?
I had one cassette, and it was Janet Jackson's Design of a Decade. And I have no idea where I got it, but I listened to it. I basically ran it into the ground. I listened to it anytime I was in the car. But, like, the reason why I have no idea where I got it is because my mom was, like, really into grunge and, like, alternative music in the 90s. So I don't think she would have given it to me, but I have no idea how it crossed my path and then became my, like, favorite tape.
All right. It was a cherished part. This one piece of technology of your childhood memory. We'll go out, I think, with a little Janet Jackson. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Yes.